Welcome to Wilderness Podcast, a passion project about wilderness and wild places, with your host, Adam Bronstein. Hello, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Wilderness Podcast. If you're listening via web browser, I encourage you to X out of that and to go to your favorite podcasting app, whether it's on your desktop or your phone. Search for Wilderness Podcast. You'll find the green logo with the bear. And there you can subscribe to be notified of new releases. Go back in time and listen to past episodes, and you can pick up where you left off with this episode. So in this episode, I speak with Gary McFarlane, Ecosystems Director, and Katie Billadue, the staff attorney with Friends of the Clearwater in Idaho. We talk all about roadless areas, their history, Rare 1, Rare 2. These are the roadless area review and evaluations done by the Forest Service. Fractures in the wilderness movement over Rare 2, the National Forest Policy Act, the influence of industry on roadless areas, the nitty-gritty of the Clinton 2001 roadless rule, state-specific roadless rules, loopholes in the roadless rule, all about the new Friends of the Clearwater roadless report for Idaho and Montana, duplicity in the Forest Service on what constitutes protections, out of control and accelerating timber extraction, and why we must begin taking roadless lands protection seriously. I've been wanting to do an episode on the roadless rule and roadless lands for quite a while, and this new report from the Friends of the Clearwater really motivated me to finally get my act together and get this episode together. It's such an important topic, and there's a lot of detail and nuance, and it really deserves a long conversation. So before we jump in, I want to read a quote from Aldo Leopold. It says, "One of the penalties of an ecological education is that one lives alone in a world of wounds. Much of the damage inflicted on the land is quite invisible to the layman. An ecologist must either harden his shell and make believe that the consequences of science are none of his business, or he must be the doctor who sees the marks of death in a community and believes itself well and does not want to be told otherwise." If you spend enough time in wilderness areas or in roadless areas that have not been logged, you're able to ascertain a baseline. You're able to understand what a natural condition looks like. With this knowledge and understanding, when you go to the rest of the national forest, you might notice there aren't many big trees around. You might notice that there's a lot of roads and temporary roads, that the soil's dried out, that there's slash piles. Maybe you don't hear many birds. All these wounds are there. They're on the land. And whether we notice them or not is a whole other question. Sometimes when we're too busy recreating, we don't slow down to really see what we're doing to the planet and to our public lands. Our roadless lands contain some of our last big trees that are unfortunately at this time accessible to the Forest Service. And the Forest Service is not taking the spirit and the intent of the roadless rule seriously. They're getting around it in different ways, different loopholes, which we discuss in this episode. It's always been up to the citizens and the conservation groups to speak up on behalf of wildlands. We wouldn't have any wilderness if it wasn't for activists and concerned citizens. So we need to keep that fight up, and we need to realize that our roadless lands are under threat. They're not protected. The roadless rule is not working as intended. And we have to finish the job of protecting whatever roadless lands we have left as wilderness. The base is shrinking so fast. We've already degraded the vast majority of our national forests and our BLM lands. And it's really time to step up and to finally get this done. So with that said, I hope you enjoy the episode. It's a lot to think about. And please speak up for our roadless lands. And I hope that you'll support groups like the Friends of the Clearwater, who are doing such important work that so many other groups are just unwilling to do today. Okay, let's jump in. So we've got Gary McFarlane and Kate Billadue. Do you go by Kate or Katie?
Katie.
Okay, from the Friends of the Clearwater in Northern Idaho, thanks for joining me on the program, guys. I really appreciate your time after work hours.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yes, thanks very much.
I've been wanting to do a program on the roadless rule for a while, and so I'm really excited to talk to you guys and introduce my audience to the roadless rule. I'm sure many have heard about it, but you guys really know the details. And first off, could you just introduce yourselves? Maybe let's start with Gary and just tell us your position and your organization and what you work on generally.
Well, I'm Gary MacFarlane. I'm the Ecosystem Defense Director, which is a mouthful for Friends of the Clearwater. I work on a little bit of everything, from policy, given the situation right now with nonprofits and COVID-19. I also do a lot of the fundraising and outreach work, but we all have to be sort of jacks of all trades, and so it's also true, I think, of Katie as well. So I've been doing this type of work off and on, as either paid or as a volunteer for, close to 40 years.
My name is Katie Billidoux. I'm the staff attorney at Friends of the Clearwater, and I do a lot of the same things Gary does, with the exception of occasionally I've been in court on behalf of Friends of the Clearwater, but mostly it's behind the scenes and commenting on projects and thinking about the most strategic ways that we can save the resources that we have and save the wild areas.
Well, let's talk about one of those resources, and it's the roadless rule and our roadless areas. So let's get into some detail about what are roadless areas. Maybe you want to start with the history and just what they are.
Well, I can take a crack at that. Katie, if you want to fill in, go ahead. But
okay. These
are areas that could potentially become wilderness. That's the reason they were identified in the first place. And this history goes back to actually the Wilderness Act and before. When the Wilderness Act passed, the Forest Service was obligated only to study areas that had administratively been protected as primitive areas for potential wilderness designation. The other two agencies at the time, Fish and Wildlife Service and Park Service, were required to study all of their roadless areas. But because of changes in policy, including the National Environmental Policy Act, and the Forest Service's recognition that it needed to look at some areas because they were pressured by wilderness advocates to look at other areas, the Forest Service in the early 1970s started to look at roadless areas. Now, the Nixon administration was going to require the Forest Service to go out and inventory all of these areas. The Forest Service didn't want to do that. They wanted to keep that inventory as small as possible. So the Forest Service convinced them not to issue this executive order through CEQ, but they would do something called the Roadless Area Review and Evaluation 1, which was an abysmal failure. There was a lawsuit, so they started the next one, the Roadless Area and Review Evaluation number 2, and that ended.
Sorry, Gary. I'm going to jump in here. Often roadless area review and evaluation is abbreviated to RARE. So when you hear RARE 1 and RARE 2, that's what they were. And in RARE 1, part of the reason why it was a failure is because the Forest Service kind of did this quick, light, and really inadequate review of the wild areas. They took 10 months from August 1971 to June 1972 to review the entire forest system, national forest system, for the roadless area designations. And during a lot of the field stages for this review, many of the areas were like snowbound and inaccessible. So as a result, when it got to court, it got thrown out, and we're back to RARE 2, and I'll turn it back over to Gary.
That's exactly right. And the Forest Service had a policy, and I put policy in quotes because they said it wasn't policy, from one of the directors in the Forest Service called Costley. And he came up with this guidance, or whatever you want to call it, the philosophy paper. And that was some of the beginnings of what has been known as the Purity Doctrine. And what they wanted to do with that, and there's two sides to this, and it's important to our story, both sides. But the first side is the Forest Service wanted to limit the number of areas that could be evaluated. So they did quick and dirty, as Katie said, but also areas that might have an impact that's unnoticeable, but they would throw that area out. They wanted to do that. But two, and this is something that most conservationists today refuse or don't know about, refuse to recognize or don't even know about, and that is the Forest Service also said, we want to be strict in administering areas that are designated as wilderness from these evaluations. Of course, they wanted to keep that very, very, very small, and so they said, we're going to administer them strictly. And so that, from my perspective, that costly memo was not all bad. It had that good part to it. And there's a great history, if anybody's interested in the history of the wilderness preservation system in roadless areas, in a book by Craig Allen called The Politics of Wilderness Preservation. And a lot of this detail is actually in that book. But the Forest Service was supposed to look at these roadless areas. And finally, with the passage of the National Forest Management Act, of course, RARE 2 followed that, and the, kind of the failure of RARE 2 as well, even though there was a lot of legislation that came out of it, the Forest Service was required every time they do a forest plan to look at roadless areas, areas that might be designated as wilderness, and then to make recommendations to Congress about what would happen with those areas. Now, that sort of gets us up to the beginnings of these roadless rules, because a lot of these areas that were roadless were being developed and they were no longer roadless, and the Forest Service had a policy to do that because they wanted, again, to limit the size of the National Wilderness Preservation System, and they wanted to have maximum flexibility in managing, read, clear-cutting the national forest system.
Now, let me ask a question. If I recall, after RARE 2, there were about 80 million acres of roadless identified. Is that right?
It was probably a little bit less than that, but that was close when you count Alaska in there. It's, you know, numbers vary between about, you know, 56 to 80 million, depending on how it's counted. And the reason it's so loosey-goosey is that many of the areas in RARE 2 weren't identified because they already had existing land use plans that supposedly looked at those areas and rejected them from further wilderness consideration, even though they were roadless. So that's why the number is sort of hard to pin down.
Okay, so after RARE 2, we'll just say we had about 80 million acres. How come at that time there wasn't a concerted effort by the Wilderness Society and other national groups to designate everything as wilderness and have this one big push and celebration? At this time, we were already seeing the dwindling of our wildlands. Why wasn't there a big push at this time?
That's a good question, and history, I think, is perhaps a guide. What the conservationists had done up to that point in time is that they felt it was the best interest of preserving more areas to look at them on an area-by-area basis, have some interim protection until Congress had a chance to look at those areas. And so that was the whole mindset of legislating protection for national forest roadless areas, was to do it area-by-area. The industry realized they could scare the Forest Service and maybe other people by saying, hey, look at the size of this 80 million acres or whatever is huge. Therefore, we have to limit the recommendations. And even though the Carter administration was friendlier to protecting wildlands, their recommendations were very, very poor from the conservation perspective. And so the conservation groups didn't really know how to react to that, and they sort of, that was one of the big defeats, was RARE 2 and them not going after protection of these areas.
And we're squabbling over that. We're still squabbling over all those lands today, and they're being broken up. And
right. And that's one of the mistakes. Ironically, the state of California decided to step in and do what the conservation community as a whole decided it could not do or would not do for fear of political reprisal, and that is sue on the RARE 2 environmental impact statement. The state of California didn't want.
Katie, what are some of your thoughts about how Rare 2 was handled and maybe some of the missed opportunities? And I want to talk about future opportunities too, of course, and not dwell on the past, but I think it's really important to reflect on what happened.
I guess I don't think a lot about what happened with Rare 2. I know Rare 2 was, it was still a pretty light review that left out a lot of, it left out a lot of lands with roadless characteristics, and the California versus block decision that Gary's talking about was, I think that was an important win, because what, you know, one of the things that California had sued on is the Forest Service did this Rare 2 and said, okay, these areas, these small areas, we're going to have be wilderness. We're going to release all of the rest of this stuff to be developed and to be logged. And that was kind of one of the subjects in California versus Block. And the court said, no, you have to, you know, every time you propose to go into one of these areas and it's going to lose, you know, these wilderness or roadless characteristics, you actually have to do, you have to do an environmental analysis on that. So I think that was good, but I guess, yeah, I don't know. I look at this with a lens that picks it up from, you know, from an era where California versus Block, like Rare 2 already existed. And, you know, I was in high school when the roadless rule was in college when the roadless rule was first passed. So, yeah, it's not a great answer. Sorry.
That's okay. I was too. I'm about the same age.
I was a little bit older because I'm an old guy now. But one of the things, getting back to the question, Adam, is why the environmental movement or the wilderness advocacy movement or the conservation movement didn't look at Rare 2. That caused some fracturing in the conservation movement and in some ways led to the formation of a so-called new movement, Earth First, because some of the people who had previously worked for the Wilderness Society were very disappointed in the society and the other conservation groups and their lack of boldness in going after the Rare 2 EIS. In part, though, can be understood, again, in context of the times. The conservation community felt they had more strength because they could turn national attention to individual areas and get their members from across the country to write letters about a specific area rather than trying to get them to write letters about the whole big picture. It was the industry that wanted a state-by-state approach, a very big-picture look at wilderness, because they felt at that time, and it may not be true today, but at that time they felt they had more strength when you had all of these areas together, as I said, and talking about so many areas that Congress would be less willing to designate more areas than they would if it took a long time and we looked at each area individually. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that was the mindset of industry at the time, and just the opposite was the mindset of most of the conservation community at the time.
Okay, that's good background. You know, it'd be nice just to have everything done at once and then we can go do other things. I mean, working in conservation is great, but I mean, what if tomorrow you could snap your finger and all the roadless lands were protected as wilderness? What if all the endangered species were listed and had critical habitat and so on and so forth? So it's a little frustrating, but nonetheless...
It is frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really frustrating.
Well, Adam, when I first started practicing law, there was a defense attorney that was a really good friend who had told me, like, environmental law is one of the areas where a win is temporary and a loss is permanent. And I think that kind of translates to saving these wild places as a whole. You know, the wins, they're just temporary. And I think, like, you know, there's got to always be vigilant, because on the other side, there's always going to be money to be made from exploiting these areas. And so there's always going to be that incentive to chip away at anything that's been protected, whether it's the ESA, whether it's the roadless rule, whether it's the National Environmental Policy Act, like anything.
And Adam, I think to follow up on that line of thinking, a lot of the conservationists, especially in the place that had the most national forest wildlands remaining in the lower 48, and that's the states of Idaho and Montana, they decided, at least a good subset of the conservation community decided, that it was time to do exactly what you said and come up with a more visionary approach. And so that bill, or that vision, eventually became the bill we now know today as the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act.
Right, which is not supported by the Wilderness Society currently. And it's much smaller than the RARE, too. So the madness continues. Katie, you had mentioned earlier, you said the word release. Can you explain what that means? And we should also get into what wilderness study areas are, too.
Yeah, so when I said release in terms of California versus BLOC, the Forest Service just wanted kind of a one-time review where they would take, like, you know, half of these areas or a third of these areas, all the roadless areas, and recommend them as wilderness. And for the other ones that they decided not to recommend as wilderness, they would release in that logging and road building would be allowed, like they would be allowed to be developed. Essentially, the Forest Service decided that they didn't have, for whatever reason, the Forest Service wasn't going to designate them or recommend them. The Forest Service wasn't going to recommend them as wilderness. And so they just wouldn't watch out for any more wilderness qualities, which means they could be logged. That's what I meant by release.
So when we see in wilderness bills, often wilderness study areas or roadless areas are released. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, the release language is where it, because of the context during a RARE 2, and also this applies to Bureau of Land Management wilderness study areas, for example. When legislation is passed, often there will be release language which says it releases the interim protection that, for example, a wilderness study area, be it one that was designated by Congress, and those are usually on the national forests, and they aren't everywhere, and it's they just happen in various pieces of legislation, or through the study process the Bureau of Land Management had on the public lands of the Bureau of Land Management overseas. So release means those areas are no longer under that interim protection that was either legislated or came about through the Federal Land Policy and Management Act. In context of roadless areas on the National Forest System that are not wilderness study areas, and which is the vast majority, release means and meant that sort of the interim protection those areas had, which really weren't protections per se, but the Forest Service had to basically go through and do a thorough evaluation of the wilderness characteristics before developing that area. It became policy to do that anyway because of California versus BLOC, and because of some other court cases, the forest plans were not even the place where those final decisions were made, but the site-specific project development proposals. And so release language today is generally only applied to wilderness study areas. Now, it's not a good thing, in my opinion, release language, but it's usually only applied to wilderness study areas that are on the remaining National Forest System lands or areas managed by the Bureau of Land Management.
Okay, and how do wilderness study areas fall within the roadless area conversation or container?
Well, they fall within it this way. Congress, through various pieces of legislation, some of it preceding RARE 2 in the case of some areas in Montana, some of it following the RARE 2, again, that roadless area review evaluation too, in places like California, there were some, there may be none left there, but Colorado had some, New Mexico still has some, Wyoming has some, states that had statewide wilderness bills following RARE 2, there were some places where Congress wasn't in a position to make a decision. They felt they couldn't make a decision one way or the other. So they designated those areas as wilderness study areas. And in most of those bills, they have quite good interim protection. And so those areas are part of these larger roadless areas. When they're studied, for example, in forest plans, these wilderness study areas may contain a portion, if not all, of that roadless area that's being considered in, for example, the Nez Perce and Clearwater National Forest. Of course, there's none here, but the Bridger-Teton would be a good example in Wyoming. So they are part of that roadless base.
Okay, we'll get back to roadless rule here in a minute, but it seems like release language for wilderness study areas is becoming, well, at least it's more on my radar now that I'm looking and becoming more attuned to all of this. But, you know, we're seeing it in the Gallatin Range and down in Colorado with the CORE Act, of course, in the Malheur Bill in Oregon. And there's the threat of more releases in the Palisades Wilderness Study Area in Wyoming. There's also governor councils being formed across the U.S. to take a look at the rest of the wilderness study areas, like in Montana. And these will undergo a similar process with the collaboration and compromise model to chip away at some of these areas. So we're sort of headed in the wrong direction. But anyways, let's get back to the roadless rule. And okay, so we have all these roadless lands on our national forest and lands with wilderness characteristics on our BLM lands. And I guess we're just talking about forests here in this case. But so this is our future wilderness, as you mentioned. And these areas are still being logged and roaded in some cases. Can you explain how that's possible?
Yeah, I guess I can go first. We can start with the 2001 roadless rule. So the rule is designed as a general prohibition with certain exceptions. And so it generally prohibits road building, but it has some exceptions. It generally prohibits timber harvest, but it has some exceptions. For example, in the 2001 roadless area conservation rule, the cutting, sale, or removal of timber is prohibited except for, they said, let me see here. I'm looking at the rule right now. That timber may not be cut, sold, or removed in inventoried roadless areas unless one of the following exists, and one of the exceptions is the cutting, sale, or removal is generally small diameter timber needed to, one, improve threatened, endangered, proposed, or sensitive species habitat, or two, maintain or restore the characteristics of ecosystem composition and structure, such as reduce the risk of uncharacteristic wildfire effects. So that's exception one. And before we go into why these exceptions are bad, there are three more exceptions. Another exception is the cutting, sale, or removal is permitted when it's incidental to a management activity that the rule doesn't prohibit. The third one is the cutting, sale, or removal is needed and appropriate for personal or administrative use. And when we talked about Rare 2 earlier, this is kind of where the fourth one comes in. The cutting, sale, or removal in a roadless area is permitted when roadless characteristics have been substantially altered in a portion of the inventoried roadless area due to road building and a subsequent timber harvest that happened before the area was designated. So when they first designated the 2001 roadless rule, a lot of what they used for their base came from that Rare 2 inventory. And in between the 70s and 2001, a few of those areas were logged and developed. And so that's what that fourth exception is. But I mean, the first one, to improve endangered, proposed, or sensitive species habitat, I cannot think of one endangered, proposed, or sensitive species that benefits from cutting trees. And, and this was in 2001 when I think and Gary can correct me here, when the Forest Service's kind of line was like thin the threat or reduce wildfire. And so like we know there's a lot more science on severe wildfire, and there is severe wildfire in the Northern Rockies that's been around for millennia. And so like reducing the risk of uncharacteristic wildfire effects, you know, the problem with that exception is A, like that is a natural feature of the landscape up here, and B, like climate drives fire mostly. It's not, there's nothing you can do really to fuels if there's going to be a drought. So yeah, so those are the four exceptions in the 2001 roadless rule.
Okay, so just to clarify something I said earlier, roadless areas, so they include wilderness. Just our inventoried roadless areas is our future wilderness. So we sort of have this tier of protection, right? So wilderness, designated wilderness is number one. And then our wilderness study areas. And then under that, we have our inventoried roadless areas. And then even under that, we have roadless lands that are not properly inventoried. And we know they're out there. They just need to be recognized by the Forest Service.
Yeah, they're often called unroaded areas. You'll hear the Forest Service call them unroaded lands.
Okay. All right, so we've got the 2001 roadless rule, which, you know, didn't go far enough, but I guess it was better than nothing. And then what happened where the states got to get in there and create their own roadless rules? What's that all about?
So after the Clinton administration left town and the Bush administration came in, the Bush administration actually had for a short time, they passed a state-specific roadless rule where states could apply to get their own roadless rule. And that was eventually struck down by the Ninth Circuit for violating the National Environmental Policy Act. But before it was struck down, there were two states that started drafting their own roadless rules, and those were Idaho, and it was in Colorado was the other one. And so I can't remember when the state petition process got struck down, but in 2008, Idaho came up with its own state-specific roadless rule, and I think not long after, Colorado came up with its own as well. So those two, the national forest systems, the inventory roadless areas, and those two states are managed by those two state rules.
Okay, so Montana and Alaska, they're under the 2001 rule?
Yes, Montana was a bit of an exception, I think, and Gary, you can jump in here. I think they were under the 2001 roadless rule, but the 2001 roadless rule treated the Tongass a little differently than it treated every other roadless area, because I think there were different alternatives that they were looking at with what to do with Tongass roadless areas.
What protection did the Tongass get that other places didn't?
I don't know if it was that the Tongass got more protection. I think the alternative they were looking at was allowing logging to go on a little longer before the roadless rule kicked in on the Tongass.
We need more wilderness designation. And I mentioned earlier, of course, the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act, which does protect all the roadless areas on the national forest system in a specific geographic area. But there are some other issues at play here that I think people need to understand. One is the Forest Service itself has changed a little bit. They've never changed their desire to log roadless areas. What they have done, though, is changed what protection means. Prior to the roadless rule, the policy was, let's develop these areas as fast as possible unless they are a wilderness study area or something else that Congress has said we can't develop. But since the policy now with the roadless rule is protection, they've redefined what protection means, and that includes logging. And it took them a while to figure that out between about 2001 and maybe 2010, 2011, sometime in there. They realized that those loopholes could be exploited. And so the Forest Service, besides doing just that, they're saying, well, logging is restoration. They've conflated logging and restoration. So with all this mumbo-jumbo now, and we're seeing those bitter fruits of those loopholes in the 2001 roadless rule, even though it's better than nothing, and of course in the Idaho roadless rule, because those loopholes are even bigger for the most part, and it is in theory less protective. So we're seeing much more logging than the Forest Service projected in their 2001 EIS and also the 2008 Idaho roadless rule EIS. So in roadless areas, and I think that's tragic because we are losing those wild lands, but the Forest Service claims that, oh no, this is actually protecting, we're helping to protect roadless characteristics. And when it comes time, though, to look at those areas in the forest plan, they still might be considered inventoried roadless areas, and they still may even be in their inventory. They have a new process, these unroaded areas, or they sometimes they'll call them potential wilderness or areas with potential wilderness characteristics or whatnot. I mean, they've completely confused the language around, quote, roadless areas, because they were supposed to be areas that could be designated as wilderness. When they've gone in and logged some areas, they said, oh, they will say in the forest plan, well, we were not going to recommend this area because it has some development. And that's exactly what happened in one of the cases we're looking at here on the Nez Perce National Forest. That's near a little sort of mining claim community, for lack of a better term. There are a few houses there. The newer ones are built on mining claims. They're basically summer homes or summer cabins that are patented. In other words, they are private land and inholding. Some of this roadless area was developed in a place called Oro Grande, and now the Forest Service, in their draft environmental impact statement on the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest, did not recommend that entire roadless area, even though it was only a portion that was developed. Didn't recommend the entire roadless area, in part because they said, oh, there's been some development here recently. So they've been less than honest. In fact, they've, to use a fancy word, they've dissembled, they've misled the public about their true intentions. And the Forest Service is saying one thing, but when it comes time to look at those areas for potential wilderness, they're saying, oh, well, guess what, though? That development really kind of precludes wilderness designation. And we're starting to see some of that happen across the West as well.
Yeah, well, once these areas get chopped, then it precludes them from future wilderness, right? I mean, maybe they should be designated anyways just to get the protections. But go ahead, Katie.
Yeah, so I was going to kind of jump onto what Gary was saying, and that all really kind of loops back to this first exception in the 2001 Roadless Area Conservation Rule, because it just assumes that tree cutting, sale, and removal can maintain or improve one or more of the roadless area characteristics. And the roadless area characteristics, which are the same, I think, across all three. I'm not sure about Colorado, but the roadless area characteristics are identical in Idaho and the national rule. And it's this high quality of undisturbed soil, water, and air, sources of public drinking water, a diversity of plant and animal communities, habitat for threatened, endangered, proposed, candidate, and sensitive species, and for those species dependent on large undisturbed areas of land. And then there are some primitive, semi-primitive, non-motorized, and semi-primitive motor classes of dispersed recreation, reference landscapes, natural appearing landscapes with a high scenic quality, traditional cultural properties and sacred sites, and other locally identified unique characteristics. And so it kind of comes like this first exception, and I thought it was really interesting when I was digging into the environmental impact statement for the 2001 roadless rule, and it has this idea, like it kind of floats this idea that tree cutting can improve roadless characteristics, and you know, it cites a book. I don't remember the book it cites, but one day I'm going to kind of track this down and figure out where this idea that logging to improve roadless areas or logging to improve wildlands like came from. The improving threatened, endangered, or proposed like just logging to do that just doesn't, it's not something that like I've ever seen science that says that's possible. And so what happens is there's this loophole where the Forest Service can say, we're going to go in and try to improve these roadless characteristics. What we found in Montana when the Forest Service had logged as much as it had, you know, I went in and looked at the National Environmental Policy documents that talked about what exception that they were using in the roadless rule. And 2/3 of the time they were using this first exception, which is improving habitat for endangered species and reducing the risk of uncharacteristic wildfire. And so, and what happens, and this is a super long game, which I don't think a lot of the conservation community has figured out just because it takes so much digging, is, you know, this individual project environmental analysis will say, we're going to go in, we're going to try to improve roadless characteristics by cutting trees, and then they'll do the project. And then 5, 10, 15 years later, when the forest plan gets reviewed and they look at the roadless areas they have and the unroaded lands they have and decide what they're going to recommend for wilderness, they'll look back on this area. And we've seen, in the Beaverhead Deer Lodge National Forest, what happens is it gets mapped out. And it doesn't get mapped out in a way where they said, this is what we did for this project and we're trying to improve roadless characteristics or not. Like, what they look at is, are there stumps? If so, there's a human impact. It has less or no roadless characteristics. So they're kind of going in with these like rosy glasses that they're going to improve roadless characteristics. And on the back end, like a decade later, they say, well, this area is degraded now.
Yeah, I think they know full well what they're doing.
Yeah. It's really interesting because it contrasts sharply with when I go back to that discussion of that costly memo back in 1971, contrasts sharply with what the Forest Service said it would do when administering wilderness. And the reason I'm talking about wilderness, not roadless areas here, is because I think this policy of, quote, improving roadless characteristics is the final foot in the door, the nose under the camel's tent, or whatever metaphor you want to use, that the Forest Service could, I don't know that they will, but they could take advantage of it to open up the National Wilderness Preservation System to this kind of tree cutting and logging. Now, it can't be commercial logging per se, but there are ways to get around that. The Forest Service goes in and cuts a bunch of trees, hauls them out by a helicopter, and then sells them later, possibly. I don't know, in log decks like they do on fire lines, they cut into roadless areas now. So I'm concerned about this because this kind of rationale and justification of, quote, improving roadless areas is just another way to get more logs out of the national forest system, and it could be a way to begin manipulating wilderness, even if they don't even sell those logs, wilderness in the future, because the agencies are heading down the path of, we're not going to let wilderness be wild, we're going to manipulate it to fit what we think wilderness ought to be. And that's not what the Wilderness Act talks about, but yet that's the road they're going down, and that's just the opposite of what this costly memo talked about when administering wilderness. So I'm very concerned about the future of these roadless areas and wilderness, because the roadless rule, which cost a lot of blood and treasure, so to speak, on the part of the conservation community, has not turned out be nearly as protective as it could be, and in fact could be a justification for developing areas because they are, quote-unquote, are improving the roadless characteristics. They've turned protection measures into something just the opposite.
That's really scary to think about wilderness potentially being manipulated like that. And, you know, like George Werthner likes to say, he hasn't heard of a logging project on Forest Service lands and 15 years. It's all under the guise of forest health and all this manipulation that you're talking about. And this is really scary. We kind of have to get off of this justification. The Forest Service really needs to stop playing these games. And, you know, I think if the public knew what was going on, they would be outraged. But also, the public would want to see these roadless lands protected and set aside so that they can become wilderness someday. And, you know, I think if the public knew, they would just be up in arms about it.
I do too, Adam. I would certainly hope so, because, and I think that's where the conservation community writ large hasn't done a good job. The community writ large has said the roadless rule is working. It's protecting these areas. It's the greatest thing since sliced bread, because they're playing a very perhaps cynical political game and a very partisan political game. We're hearing that the roadless rule is a good thing and a very protective thing, when the data that Katie put together for this roadless report proves that it is not protective. And the Forest Service, if it wanted to exploit roadless areas even more in the short term, I'm sure they're going to do it in the mid to long term, but even in the short term, they could justify it under these massive loopholes. And the conservation community then would be at a crossroads. This program that they've supported all along and said is the greatest thing in the world isn't, and it's not nearly as protective. And of course, there have been a few dissident voices within the movement about that, but I think it's time to stop pretending the roadless rule is as effective as the conservation community has claimed it is, and starts telling the truth about what's really happening on the ground. And that's why we put together this report, because we wanted to get it out there. We wanted to show the duplicity of the Forest Service in the way it looks at what's an impact to roadless areas, you know.
Go ahead and finish your thought, Gary.
You know, I was just saying, in terms of impacts to roadless areas, so.
Yeah, I think, I would add to that, what the Idaho Roadless Rule did is just basically it made a hierarchy of five different types of roadless areas, and then for one of those types, it imposed more protections than the 2001 National Roadless Rule, but that was like 16% of the roadless areas. Like, so after the other four actually have more exceptions than the 2001 roadless rule did, and those include where the roadless rule said small diameter trees. The Idaho roadless rule kind of eliminated the small diameter trees part and said to maximize retention of fire resilient trees, or they included like the most common, like most 57% of the Idaho roadless areas are in this category that is several rungs below the National Roadless Rule, and it's called the Backcountry Restoration Roadless Areas, where the loopholes are, you know, logging any trees to reduce hazardous fuel conditions within a community protection zone. It allows logging any trees to reduce hazardous fuels conditions outside of a community protection zone when there's a significant risk to the community. And then the final, the one on the lowest rung is these roadless areas called Idaho Roadless Rule General Forest Rangeland and Grassland Roadless Area, where there's absolutely no prohibition on logging at all. So that's just a category of roadless areas that the Forest Service can log without violating the roadless rule, and they don't need any kind of exception or justification for it.
It's just a big old mess. And, you know, I think the roadless rule is really working for those steering the ship, whether it's our government or some of these larger conservation groups, because it allows to divvy up the landscape. It allows for horse trading. You take this, we'll take that. We get to set this aside. Well, this area is destroyed anyway, so here, you can have this for extraction or for recreation and so on and so forth. So it really helps facilitate the collaboration and compromise model of conservation that we see today. Now, I want to talk about your roadless report. You guys branched out from the Clearwater and the Nez Perce area and looked at the state of Idaho and Montana. And I'm really happy you guys did this. I don't think anyone else would have who's out there today. So thanks so much for taking on this work. What were some of your big findings from this roadless report? Maybe just tell us what it is and what you found.
So we were fortunate to have at the time, the Forest Service had a roadless area coordinator for Region 1 that handled all of the Idaho roadless areas, and or he kept track, I should say, of all the Idaho roadless areas and all the Montana roadless areas. So he actually provided us some spreadsheets of an accounting he had done since 2011. And so one of the things that we did is we went in and the accounting since 2011 in both Montana and Idaho addressed, it basically was an accounting of all of the logging that has happened in the roadless area, the inventoried roadless areas under the rules exceptions. And so what I did is I took those numbers and the project he was citing with those numbers, and I did my own cross-check of them. And in Montana, from 2011, I believe, to 2018, which was as we were drafting this report, the Forest Service, he had reported, the spreadsheet that we had reported that the Forest Service had authorized logging in 33,000 acres of inventoried roadless areas in Montana. And when I did my cross check, I used the National Environmental Policy Act decision documents out of the Forest Service to kind of cross check his work. And I found that number was closer to about 39,000 acres of roadless areas that the Forest Service had authorized to log under one of the exceptions to the roadless rule. And I found that 2/3 of that time was that first exception that we talked about, where the Forest Service said this is going to improve roadless characteristics, or we're going to do this to reduce fire risk, like both of which does not have any scientific support. So that was Montana. And then in Idaho, what we did with that list is we did another cross check. And at the time in 2018, the number that had reported that the Forest Service had reported to us in terms of what they had authorized to cut in inventoried roadless areas under those exceptions was 19,000 acres. And I could only find, and confirm about 10,000 of those acres, because some of these decision memos and records of decision weren't actually available online, which is basically what I was using. So that was the first comparison. The second comparison we did was to look at the efficacy of the 2001 roadless rule by way of kind of a cross-section of time, because Friends of the Clearwater has been around since 1987, and our office has paper copies, I think, of just about every logging project that has happened on the Nez Perce and Clearwater National Forest since about 1990. So it provided a great resource in looking at what projects proposed logging and road building in roadless areas in the 1990s, from 2001 until 2008, which was when the 2001 roadless area, the national rule, applied in Idaho, and then from 2008 on. And what I found was in the 1990s, those National Environmental Policy Act documents that talked about going into roadless areas and logging them, the Forest Service was fairly honest about what was going to happen after the logging. They say, you know, we're going to cut trees, it's going to create stumps, there'll be roads cut in, there'll be still be disturbed ground from where we like drag logs to load it. This area won't have roadless characteristics when we're done with it. And so that was like the 1990s. And then from 2001 until 2008, in the beginning, you saw the same thing when there was usually the projects between 2001 and 2008, if the Forest Service started out proposing logging in a roadless area, it was never one of their final alternatives that chosen. And there were a couple of appeals where the Forest Service, you know, sometimes would say, yeah, we're going to go in, we're going to log, there are going to be roads, there are going to be stumps, it's not going to have roadless characteristics. But then you start to see this like little switch, kind of this little flip that they do, where there are some projects where they say, well, you can see them starting to test the exceptions, really, where they say, we're going to go in, we're gonna log, but we think it's going to benefit some endangered species habitat, or it's going to benefit the ecosystem. And this was still in the days where there was an appeal process after a decision. And when I got to the appeal on those decisions where they say, well, we're gonna help roadless characteristics by logging, the appeal was like, no, like you're not gonna help roadless areas by logging. It kind of struck, it found the capriciousness, I guess, of that decision. So that was like 2001 through 2008. But then the Forest Service kept testing that exception. And after 2008, you see this switch. The switch has just been flipped. And the Forest Service comes in and says, we're gonna log, but it's going to have either no impact on roadless characteristics, or it's going to help it in the long term. And that kind of, it was just a really interesting between those three sections of time. And what I saw qualitatively from the National Environmental Policy Act documents that I looked at in Montana is the Forest Service in Montana is doing the same thing now. So although we couldn't really, like we didn't have access to the logging projects from 2001 to 2008 in Montana or in the 1990s like we did for the Nez Clear, I did see that same kind of reasoning when I went to look at the Forest Service's justification for logging in roadless areas.
So these are all just arbitrary and capricious right out of the gate, huh?
Well, I mean, we can call it arbitrary and capricious. Whether a court finds that legally is entirely a separate question. But yeah, no, it was an interesting flip of reasoning, and it never was really explained, and it's not supported by science.
Gary, are you thinking anything?
Oh, yeah. Oh, we found that even in Idaho, amount of logging that was projected was greater what happened on the ground than was projected for the time frame we looked at. It was much greater in Montana. We also found, of course, in Idaho, because there is not the prohibition as strictly construed for road building, there were a lot of roads that were built. I don't remember how many miles, a few miles, up to several miles of roads built in roadless areas in Idaho. Of course, these are so-called temporary roads. And, you know, there's also the same kind of duplicity from the Forest Service on what is a road anymore. We found that there was a court case in Montana. What the Forest Service called that road they were building into a roadless area, they called it a feature or something like that, Katie? I don't remember the name.
Yeah, I think it was a feature.
So they were trying to get feature. Away with calling things, building roads and saying, well, it's really not a road. It's they have some new terminology. They say it causes less damage. Well, we're not going to build a temporary road. We're going to build that swing trail. You know, there's all this. It's a very Orwellian world in which the Forest Service inhabits now in terms of impacts to roadless areas. And it's kind of pervasive, and it's sort of an anything goes, and, you know, development is whatever we say it is. Protection is whatever we say it is. Wildlife habitat is whatever we say it is. Water quality is whatever we say it is at any given point in time, and it can be different, and it doesn't have to be consistent through time. So it's bleeding discretion at every single opportunity, and it's a huge problem.
You think this is a consequence? Go ahead, Katie.
Pardon? Oh, I was just going to say, I forgot to also add that we got updated numbers for roadless areas in Idaho from the Forest Service that I have yet to cross-check against anything. But, you know, in 2018, they had reported to us that they had authorized logging in 19,000 acres of inventoried roadless area. And this year, their report is up to 86,000 acres. They took like a 400% jump in the last 2 years. And I'm not sure if all of those have been like signed projects, but they're definitely floating out there, and they propose to log in roadless areas. So this is where, you know, if nobody checks them, like a lot of roadless acres are going to be just lost.
I wonder how much limits to growth factors into all of this, or if it's just, you know, carelessness and greed or whatnot. Like, do you think this is all a product of limits to growth, Gary?
Possibly. There are limits, as we know. It could be. You know, that's maybe a kinder way to look at it. With increasing pressures, the agency is supposed to produce, quote unquote, more board feet now, and Forest Service is. Over the last few years, we've seen the sale rate here on the Nez Perce and Clearwater National Forests. Basically, over the last 20-year average, it's gone up considerably. The average is about, somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 million board feet prior to this big upswing, and now they're upwards of, 80 million now. So there's some pretty big changes. And I think there are, it could be that. But I also think I think it's a part of this, the agency that no longer sees wildlands as valuable. As bad as the Forest Service was in 1971, when a lot of this started, or 1964, you know, the Wilderness Act was passed precisely because the Forest Service was not protecting their administratively designated wilderness and their administratively designated primitive areas. They weren't protecting them adequately. When they were reevaluating their primitive areas to become wilderness, they would shrink, and that's what spurred the Wilderness Act. So the agency's never been good, but at least there were people in the agency that saw the value in having some wildlands protected and very strictly protected. But we're not seeing that. It's all discretionary. They're turning protection, both regulation and laws, into procedural processes. And I think that's tragic, because they're trying to get rid of any of the teeth in the environmental laws or regulations like the roadless rule. And by interpreting them in ways that they were never intended to be interpreted, and in ways I don't even think that, for example, that the 2001 roadless rule, that the intent necessarily was to do what they're doing now, like in Montana and many other states. I hear the same problems from conservationists in California and in Utah as well. So I don't know what the problem is entirely. Yes, there's 7.5 billion people on the planet. The United States is growing. One of the few industrialized nations. It probably has the fastest growth rate of any of the industrialized nations, with a maybe a possible exception of some of the smaller ones in terms of population. But it's a huge puzzle to me as to why the agency is behaving the way it is, unless they just want to have complete control over the national forest system and have have no accountability to the public, to Congress, or even to the administration.
Yeah, I just want to get on my soapbox here a little bit. So, you know, I know that you guys are really concerned about what's happening out there with our biodiversity and extinction and climate crisis, and so many of my listeners are too. And Congress and our agencies and even the large and regional environmental groups, like if we're talking about Idaho and Montana, the Idaho Conservation League and the Wilderness Society and the Montana Wilderness Association, we really need to start looking at these large protection packages like the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act and just set these areas aside. We're running out of time, and it's becoming reckless at this point. We need to start looking at rewilding Earth, and we can't even protect the remaining roadless lands that we have left. So I'm really concerned about this, and I know most of the public is, and we just need leadership in this time. It's so critical. It's getting very scary out there, and we're not facing up to the fact that this extinction crisis is really going to start to catch up with us quickly.
I couldn't have said it better. That sums it up. There are limits,
yeah.
And for whatever reason, now I'll just quote a title of the book, The Arrogance of Humanity, or The Arrogance of Humanism, we think those limits do not apply to us, but yet they do. I mean, nature bats last, and when nature bats last, it could be catastrophic, not just for our civilization, but also for all the other species we take down with us with our short-sightedness.
Yeah, Adam, one of the things your listeners can do, too, is contact their congressional representatives about the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act. Like, Friends of the Clearwater was actually in D.C. in 2019 trying to educate our, the leaders and the congressmen and the senators about what we're seeing and, you know, a good way to slow this down. And yeah, it's regional and the rest of the roadless areas do need to be looked at, but this is it's a good start. And, you know, when we appeal to our Idaho delegation, they're not excited about this. I mean, like one of the senators is a former timber lawyer, I'm pretty sure. But you know, I think one of the important things is to remember that these roadless, like the roadless areas in Montana, they belong to you and me and Gary and every member of like every taxpayer. And it's the same with the roadless areas of Idaho. It's not like the state of Idaho doesn't get to decide what, you know, doesn't get to take away and log like the national public's federal lands, right? Like, you know, we get a say in the Grand Canyon because, you know, it's not, the Grand Canyon's down in Arizona, but this is like, it's everybody's, it's all Americans. And so like, it's, you know, these roadless areas in Idaho and Montana, like they're all yours. And so call your senators, call your congressmen, try to get these protected, tell them to listen.
Doesn't Rewilding Earth have some recommendations that they just are bringing before the Biden administration right now?
They do. And one of them includes roadless area protection. And we had a good discussion with the folks there saying, look, we have data from the Forest Service that shows what's actually happening on the ground. And we put it in the roadless report, and we think that we have to have a very strong request, like these areas need to be protected as wilderness, and that these areas, you know, at the very least, they have to go back and fix all of these roadless rules and end those loopholes, at the very least.
Yeah, let's get our act together, everybody.
Yes, we need to, and I'll just, you know. You mentioned one thing earlier, Adam, and I think it's important. We did this. We expanded out because we had to make the case. Ideally, a large organization should have done this kind of a report, but nobody out there was willing to take this on. And it's really, I think, says volumes about the state of the wildland protection movement in this country when, as you mentioned, some of the big groups before really are just too comfortable in their supposed political access to make the kind of analysis, let alone change, necessary to protect wild country.
I'm very grateful to you guys. Very grateful. And I know my listeners are too. And I hope my listeners will support the Friends of the Clearwater. Can you please give us your website address?
Gary?
www.friendsoftheclearwater, all one word, friendsoftheclearwater.org.
Any other thoughts about roadless lands, the roadless rule, anything else, guys?
I think you should go out and visit some roadless areas if you're near them, because I think I went out backpacking with a friend this past summer, and she mostly just, when she gets out, she goes to wilderness areas. And so I think it was a wild experience, because we were in an area in Idaho in the Hoodoo roadless area, which is kind of up Kelly Creek and has some famous, I guess, the infamous Hanson Meadows and stuff. And it was just incredibly gorgeous and knocked her socks off. And it was a roadless area. It's not protected as wilderness. So that would be my pitch.
Gary, closing thoughts?
Yeah, protect these places and do whatever you can, be it a piece of art, write a letter, a poem, or whatnot, but just get out and do something.
Okay. Well, this has been a great chat. I learned so much. I hope my listeners did too. And again, thank you so much to the both of you and Friends of the Clearwater and all your supporters. I wish that there were more organizations like yours out there today. We need you so much, so thank you.
Thank you, Adam.
Thank you, Adam.
Great work you do.
Yeah, thank you so much. I love this podcast.
Oh, great. Thanks. I'm so happy to hear that. All right,
yeah,
guys.
I listen to a few of them now, and they're just great.
Excellent. Thank you so much. All right, have a good night.
You too.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Wilderness Podcast. You can find us online at wildernesspodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe through your podcasting app. If you'd like to support this podcast, please visit wildernesspodcast.com/support. Thanks for listening.